Hello again, and thank you for joining me on my second podcast. Often, when I want to relax, I listen to Nat King Cole. It isn't just that wonderful voice and his ability to talk straight to you. It's that my older brother and sister were playing him from when I was a toddler. The magic has stayed with me. But of course, from when I was 11 or 12, another kind of music arrived. I remember a gang of us heading for Rainsdale Beach, girls and boys running across the road to get to Liverpool's amazing electric overhead railway, another world's first for Liverpool. Sheila had her transistor radio and it was playing Del Shannon's Runaway. Somehow she tripped and the radio rattled across the cobbles. Game girl, she got up laughing. Game Del Shannon too, he was still singing. The soundtrack to those early teenage years was those sunny high school, all-American happy days before Peggy Sue got married and when Carl Perkins' blue suede shoes were still scuff-free. Sometimes at school, we'd pray for rain in the lunch break so that Frank Stubbs, ex-Olympian and schoolteacher, would open the school up and Frankie Avalon, Paul Anker, Buddy Holly and Elvis would bring boys and girls together at the high school bop. When brill-creamed quiffs were de rigueur and girls would whisper, "Cookie, cookie, lend me your comb." Heads filled with a big screen technicolor world of impossibly long cars and impossibly glamorous men and women. Then, somewhere between Lime Street Station in Liverpool and the Reeperbahn in Hamburg, the world changed. Months before Love Me Do snuck into the charts with a mass buyout of that momentous single by men's record stores, a rather cool member of the class announced that her visits to a club in Matthew Street had convinced her that four lads from Liverpool would be the next big thing. "No chance, Linda," says I. "No chance, Richard. Pourquoi?" "Check the top 20 records, Linda. 18 out of 20, if not 20 out of 20, are from the USA. That's where they do this music. From Little Richard to the Everly Brothers. And the Beatles. Who came up with that name? At least they should have called it... What did you say his name was? Right. So it should have been John Lennon and the Beatles. Like it's Buddy Holly and the Crickets." And that unerring insight into how success is won or lost has never left me. Linda and I shared our class with a guitarist who occasionally held us all mesmerised with his playing, jet black hair and soulful brown eyes. If you join Adam Scott on his excellent rock and roll walk, he'll tell you about how Tom Evans ended up in Denmark Street in a flat with a basement studio, where he and the rest of the group, who, with a name change by Paul McCartney, became Badfinger. On Adam's walk, he says how our art schools became the cradles of the 1960s rock and roll explosion. Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin went to Sutton Art School. Ray Davis of the Kinks attended Hornsey Art School. Pete Townsend of The Who went to Ealing Art School. And a decade later, Joe Strummer of The Clash went to the Central School of Art and Design. And fellow band member Mick Jones went to the West London School of Art and Design. And of course, John Lennon went to the Liverpool College of Art. John Lennon's generation had one big advantage over their American contemporaries. While 8 million tons of napalm set fire to the villages and farmland of Vietnam, young American men were risking their lives in the front line. By 1968, there were 500,000 of them joining Apocalypse Now. Born in October 1940, John Lennon was one of the first to enjoy the freedom to create that the ending of national service allowed. And perhaps that went partway to explaining the enormous change in rock music that was the British invasion. Zombies and animals included in that invasion. A mass attack of British bands on the American Billboard Hot 100. My brother Harry did his national service in the Coldstream Guards. On leave, he'd sit in the back garden, painstakingly spit and polishing his boots to a mirror shine. I'd sit behind him, working away. Sadly, I never achieved any kind of shine on my tough boots. Whatever happened to tough boots? Born in 1947, me and Tom Evans easily escaped the short back and sides and being made men of that military service had ensured for an earlier generation. Tom co-wrote, "I can't live if living is without you," a poignant title for their most successful song, because in 1975, aged only 28, Pete Ham, Tom's co-writer, decided he couldn't go on living. 8 years later, Tom Evans came to the same decision. When it came to making my way in the real world, I knew I had none of my father and brother's talent for carpentry, and I certainly lacked Tom Evans' musical talent. Well, any musical talent whatsoever, really. The only subjects I really liked were history and English literature. Tennyson's Ulysses, and in particular the lines, "The lights begin to twinkle from the rocks, the long day wanes, the slow moon climbs, the deep moans round with many voices. Come, my friends, 'tis not too late to seek a newer world. Push off, and sitting well in order, smite the sounding furrows, for my purpose holds to sail beyond the sunset and the baths of all the western stars until I die." Yes, those lines were probably partly responsible for where I did finally end up. But a teacher, who happened to be flipping through his Guardian, said, "Richard, what about this? Littlewood chain stores are looking for young men," and yes, it was men, "to join their management training scheme." Somehow, whatever I said convinced the 6'5" commando, who seemed to be in charge of the 3-man interviewing squad, that I was the very 16-year-old genius who would be running the flagship Oxford Street store within 3 years. After 18 months of bluffing my way through the main Liverpool store and two other smaller stores, I found myself at 18, supposedly running the food department of the Wrexham store. By far my most successful decision during the entire period was to finally go abroad. I would travel through Europe like Byron, destination Rome. The evening before this grand tour was to start, I chatted with the management team as the store slowly closed up for the day. The manager, a lean and precise man, said, "So where is it, your holiday?" "Rome," said I, enjoying the admiring looks around me. Foreign travel was still a novelty in 1965. "How are you getting there?" he asked. "Hitchhiking," I said. The admiring glances turned to looks of stunned amazement. Then Mr. Armitage started to chuckle. The first time I'd seen anything that could be vaguely characterised as amusement in the 6 months that I'd worked there. I said, "Is that funny? Hitchhiking?" He said, I'm just imagining the car stopping and asking where you're going. And when you tell him Rome, you say, "Oh, well, I'm only going as far as the chip shop." By then, I was the only one not weeping with laughter. It seemed to me that hitchhiking was definitely the most efficient and enjoyable way to travel to Rome. But I was delighted to see all of them laughing. It was the first and only time that I was able to enjoy that sight in the 8 months that I spent watching the women run the food department smoothly and efficiently, despite my interference. It took 2.5 years for it to finally dawn on me that managing, or even being in, a large retail store was something I was most definitely not cut out for.